On October 1st of 1943, the Germans ordered that the final solution would be put into effect against Danish Jews. The final solution meant deportation and certain death. Incredibly, given what they were up against, the Danish people said no. Tens of thousands of them mounted a spontaneous rescue operation to save their countrymen and some of those who had been refugees from Germany. On Conversations, we'll hear the story. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC. This is Conversations. Welcome, please, our guest, Terkel Strada. Welcome, Terkel. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
My first question is about the occupation of Denmark and of Norway, because occupation of these countries was very different than occupation of other countries around Europe. How is that so, and what made it different?
Well, the occupation of Denmark and Norway was one action of the Germans. Actually, they didn't especially want to occupy Denmark, but they sort of had to because Norway was the main objective, and Norway was very strategically important to the Germans because of the access to the Atlantic. Denmark was only to be a stepping stone, and they actually had considerations if they should take only like bases in Denmark, or if they should take the whole country. The occupation of Norway was a proper military action, you could say, whereas the occupation of Denmark was over and done within a couple of hours, basically because the Danish defense was very weak. The Danish defense was built on the presupposition that the country could not be defended by military means, but only by diplomatics. That means there was some resistance on part of the Danish army, but only as much as to the point that it was clear to everybody that if the Germans mean to occupy the country, there's no sense in having the country spoiled and having everything destroyed, and they would be able to do that no matter what the Danish army did. So in a couple of hours, the fighting was fighting ceased, and the Danish government agreed to, under protest, to arrange the situation and go into some sort of a cooperation with the occupying power. In Norway, on the other hand, there was heavy fighting for weeks and weeks, and the British and the French sent an expeditionary force to northern Norway to help the Norwegians, which was not very successful. But fighting lasted most of the beginning of the summer in Norway, until finally the capitulation was there, and the Norwegian government and the king were able to get over to England and continue there as an exile government, whereas in Denmark, government, the king, stayed in Copenhagen and entered this, you could say, pragmatic cooperation with the occupying power, which aimed at preserving the country from war destructions and preserving as much of Danish sovereignty which was still left. And the Germans gave guarantees that a widespread sovereignty would still be allowed in Denmark.
The Danish government negotiated with what it had to offer. It set certain conditions. We will not do this. We will not invoke a death penalty. We will not allow discriminatory laws in our country, but we will, in trade for our relative sovereignty, give you food, which is something, and not munitions, but like aircraft parts and the like, that the Germans needed. Is that right?
That is right. I mean, in 1940, especially after the Western campaign of the Germans against the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France, which also was successful for the Germans, everybody in Denmark would think that this occupation is going to last a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And the people of Denmark sort of adjusted to the situation in the way that there was a national revival, a gathering around national ideas and the national identity, much actually like the national gathering of the Danes in northern Schleswig The parts which were occupied by the Germans 1864 and given back to Denmark 1920 after the First World War. So the Danes felt very much like, there's nothing we can do about the situation except trying to get the best out of it. And in order to keep society running, to keep employment and so on and so forth, well, Danish agricultural produce had to be sold somewhere. England was the traditional market for these things, and England, of course, was not in the picture anymore. Mm-hmm. Denmark also had to import all of its fossil energy, that means coal and coke and whatever, and this also usually came from England in return. Now Denmark had to direct all its trade to Germany. This was basically the agricultural trade, and as you will know, in agriculture you do not have to have very much disturbance in the field of market, in the field of sales and exports, or in an export-oriented agriculture. Before the whole ecological and economical balance will sort of turn over and fall apart, which would have tremendous effects on the society. The deliverances of industrial goods were only introduced somewhat later, namely after 1942, as the Germans started placing orders on industrial goods, basically airplane goods, shipbuilding, and so on and so forth, in the occupied countries to avoid the heavy air bombing done by the Allied forces on Germany proper.
This is Terkel Strædel with us today on Conversations. He is an historian from Denmark, where he works at a university as a professor. His training is in the history of labor movements, labor in Denmark. But around 1988, a research project was developed in Germany to research facts about the war, about the final solution against the Jews, about the treatment of the people in countries in Europe during World War II, and he was asked to participate. He has developed a whole body of interest and body of knowledge around Holocaust study now. Terkel Strædel, our guest on Conversations. On European Journal in October of 1993, a man who is Jewish and lives in Denmark and was rescued during this operation said life for Jews in Denmark during occupation was very much like life for Danes anywhere in that country, indicating that this was very unusual, that people had freedom of movement and had the privileges of normal society around them. What was life like in Denmark at that time? Was there a certain unreality, having been only partially affected by the war, or were people very aware that the danger of Germany could be enacted at any time?
Well, people, of course, were very aware that the Germans were in the country, that German soldiers were everywhere, that also German law was ruling in the area which had to do with the security of the German Wehrmacht, the army. The whole country was darkened every night, for one instance, and there was a shortage of a lot of produce, which was usually on the Danish market. Also the living standard, especially of the workers, were dropping fairly much during the first and second year of the occupation. So the impact of the German occupation was rather heavy on Denmark. But on the other hand, the more terroristic parts of German occupation did not occur in Denmark the way it did in Poland, for instance, in these first years of the war. In Denmark, it only the harder hand of Germany was only to be felt after 1943. So until then, there was some kind of a normality still in the society, and the Jews, they had basically the same living conditions. The Danish government refused to agree to any anti-Jewish measures, to any anti-Jewish discriminatory laws in Denmark. Although this was suggested several times by the Germans, for instance by Hermann Göring, and every time these suggestions came up, the Danish government would say, we do not know of a Jewish problem in Denmark. And this was the approach not only of the government, but also of the Danish people as a whole, although we must admit that there were some 3 to 5% who voted for and opted for the Nazis, basically members of the German-speaking minority in southern Jutland, which is the border area to Jutland. One could say that was quite a normal part for German-speaking, German-cultured people to identify more with Germany than with Denmark. Which does not justify that the identification was with Adolf Hitler's Germany. But the situation of the Danish Jews would be that of a normality, but a very tensed one, since of course every Jew in Denmark would know already from the 1930s when about 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 Jewish refugees from Germany, Austria and Czechoslovakia came to the country would know how Jews were treated and persecuted in Germany. And everybody would expect that at some time the same thing is going to happen in Denmark. 1939, the Yellow Star of David was introduced in Poland. 1941 in Germany and the other countries occupied by Germany. But the Yellow Star was never imposed upon the Danish Jews because the Danish government played the role of a protective shield between the German occupational institutions and the Danish Jews. And this is also a reason why the Danish Jews, the vast majority of them, opted for the policy of cooperation, since they saw this as the only protection against persecution. There were Jewish activists also, mostly Zionist activists, who had come up from Germany and knew what is going to be expected from the Germans, who wanted a more activistic line, who wanted resistance acts to participate in these, and also that the community should be more active, prepare for illegality. But the community as in general refused this and saw this as a very dangerous act which could provoke these actions from the Germans.
Yeah, if you provoke the dragon, there's no telling what would happen.
Yeah, the best thing, like the German Jewish community saw it, and it was supported very heavily in this respect from the whole Danish government, the best thing would be to pretend that one wasn't there at all, so that they wouldn't see.
Hitler grew, if I'm reading this right, more and more impatient with this arrangement, didn't he? And was it Hitler's impatience that turned things around in the summer of 1943?
No, you couldn't say that. Hitler was not very aware of the Danish question and the situation in Denmark at all. Actually, the situation in the course of 1943 got very tensed in Denmark. There were a number of sabotage, I could say a whole wave of sabotage flowing over the country.
By civilians,
by Danish civilians, by Danish resistance fighters who would blow up German military targets, or also Danish industrial plants working for the Germans. And these sabotages, of course, then were answered by the local German commanders with different measures, reprisals and things like that, which again provoked a wave of general strikes throughout the country in the course of August 1943. The situation was in August 1943 becoming very unpeaceful. At the same time, the head of German civil administration, Werner Best was his name, an SS general, was sending one telegram to Berlin after the other one to calm down, to pretending that everything was calm and that he would have everything in his hand. Then at one time, this was also in August, Hitler had a visitor in his headquarters, and this was a photographer who had been shooting a film in Norway, and he had been traveling through Denmark on his way back. And Hitler was a film buff, mm-hmm. you could say. Mm-hmm. Everything which was modern, and that was really something for him. So he invited this photographer, also a Nazi photographer, to his place and to see these films, and also conversating him about the situation in Denmark. And the man said, well, that place, it's almost an uprising there. And Hitler did not know anything about that, and he became furious. So, because everything he had heard was rather, everything is calm. So he ordered Werner Best to come to his headquarters and gave him a scolding. What is this? Are you misleading your Führer? Are you misleading your leader?
The worst thing he could do.
The worst thing he could do. And after that, Werner Best went back to Denmark, and he was heavily instructed to impose the policy of the Iron Hand upon Denmark. And a couple of days later, on August 29, there was martial law imposed upon Denmark, and the Danish government chose then as a response to retire.
Retire means to be no more in this.
That means to be no more, but not a proper retirement in the sense that another government could be founded. Only that means not to function anymore. Yeah. And at the same time, also the Danish parliament, which was to start its work for the season's works in these days, also chose not to meet again until the situation had changed. That means the Germans were out of the country.
This is Terkel Strada with us on Conversations. We're talking about a rescue operation that saved the lives of nearly 8,000 people in 1943. The Germans, Werner Best, determined to create a raid on Denmark on October 1st, 1943, which was the Sabbath and which was Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. What happened? And I'm thinking, I want to know what the Danish people did.
Yes. There had been a warning out from the Germans a couple of days before that evening, when the German action actually was taken against the Jews, when this police raid was conducted. So most of the Jews actually had gone underground and could not be found by the Gestapo and their helpers. This was only possible in the way that a lot of Danish citizens, normal citizens, joined in and tried to help the Jews get out of the way. It was the warning was given out on August 29. That means they had exactly 2 days to adjust to this new situation, to convince themselves that this time the rumors are true, because there had been rumors all the time that the Germans would at some time take actions against the Jews. And when convinced about that, to seek shelter somewhere, to go underground, so to speak, and then to try to get out of the country. And I remember sitting in Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the archive which houses a lot of testimony from Jews all over the world about the Holocaust and also about the Danish situation. And many of these witnesses describe these days as a rather marvelous experience for them. There are frequent evidence that people were approached up to 5 or 6 times in the course of one day by total strangers in the streets, Danes who would say to them, "You're Jewish, aren't you? You look Jewish," or "I happen to know that you're Jewish," or you cannot be here in the street. You must come to us, come to our place. Mm. People were approached in the tram. "Don't stand around here. Don't you see you're in danger? Come out. We'll bring you away." I remember one testimony also by an ambulance driver who on that day, when he over his, when he in the alarm station learned that there was an action going on against the Jews, he simply took his ambulance and took the day off and went to the nearest telephone booth and started phoning, finding names he presumed were Jewish in the telephone book and called them. And when there were nobody there, okay, nothing to do. When the people were there, he would say, "You are in danger. There's the Germans are going to come. You must disappear." And when the people, when he felt there's despair, people don't know what to do, he would drive out there in his ambulance, put them in the ambulance, and take them to one of the Copenhagen hospitals. Most of the Jews were living in Copenhagen. Almost all of the Danish Jews. And the hospitals were centers of this health organization, which actually organized in the course of very few hours on a total spontaneous basis. Nothing was prepared for that. But the personnel, the doctors, the nurses, and so on and so forth, of the Danish hospitals already had made up their mind about these things half a year before, when there had been rumors that an action is going to come from the Germans against the Jews, and they had at that time signed a protest petition to the Germans to leave that to against these this presumed action. So in the hospitals, everybody knew who was to count on, who was to be trusted.
That's what I was just thinking. Sure.
Yeah, sure. And they started then, sending home all the patients who were able to walk. And filling up the empty beds with Jews who weren't ill at all, and also filling, making all the paperwork to make pretend that now this was a normal hospital with normal patients, they were able to prevent the Germans from searching the hospitals. This cost a lot of money in bribery. The German police and the German army, the army was not taking directly part, but did a lot of the logistics of the operation, but German police and especially the army were rather corrupt, although in the you could say in the tradition of the German army this could not be the case, but in Denmark this was the fact. So it was possible to prevent them from entering the hospitals, but the situation was of course very tense, and there were also people, Jewish people and helpers, caught in the streets, caught on the way from the city and out of the capital. The capital was curfewed, roadblocks all over the place to cut it off from the surrounding countryside. And the Jews had to get into the countryside to get to the fishermen's villages to make contact with fishermen who were willing then to take them over to Sweden. And there were catastrophes where Jews were caught during this whole operation, especially also at the roadblocks. But most of them got out of the capital in the course of the next days, arrived at the different harbor towns and villages, and the fishermen were willing to take them across, provided they got paid for it.
Each step of this operation was relatively unplanned and spontaneous, which means there had to be a great deal of trust on the part of Danes, not just for their charges, the people they were hoping to rescue, but for the next person. The ambulance driver had to trust the person at the hospital who he might or might not know, who had to trust the person who was traveling across country. Is that?
Yes.
Phew, this is fairly remarkable.
Well, there had to be a great deal of trust, but there also people also had to take chances.
Yes.
And in most of the cases, chances taken. Well, it was successful, so they could be taken. They needed good luck also to do this. But I think that it was possible for most people within networks where people knew each other to trust each other. And the situation emerging on August 29, when the government retired and the policy of cooperation with the Germans was finally broken, created a clear situation in Denmark, which was also a relief for a lot of people who had been functioning in different functions and felt that there had been too much pragmatism and too much bargaining with the Germans. So a lot of people felt kind of a relief and felt relieved to be able to show that this is now the time to do something against the oppressor.
On Conversations, this is Terkel Strada. I'm Susan McGinnis. We're talking today about a rescue operation that took place in October of 1943. An historian referred to this as, and I guess I'm just underscoring your last thought, and an explosion of rage and of will. We will do something about this.
Yes. The funny thing, when you ask Danes about why did they do it what was actually their thoughts about it, most people would say, well, that was just the normal thing to do. That was what one should expect a person to do in a situation where human beings are in danger, are on the run, are becoming refugees. One should help them. It's a moral duty, so to say, and this is the right thing to do. I don't think very many of the Danes are becoming active in these days, and that were really a matter of tens of thousands, did give it very, you could say, very deep and thoughts what they were doing, but that was only a spontaneous reaction. Probably on the grounds that, of course, the Danish population during the years from 1940 to 43 had become decidedly anti-German, mm-hmm. which was not so clear in the year of 1940, where everybody sort of arranged himself with the occupation.
A certain exhaustion with the occupation, I would expect. Terkel Strada is a professor at the University of Roskilde in Denmark, where he is a teacher of Scandinavian, German, and European modern history, specializing, as I've said lately, in Holocaust studies. His master's in history and social studies came from the University of Roskilde in 1981, and he did postgraduate to doctoral level study in contemporary history at the University of Copenhagen. This is Conversations on KUAC. I'm Susan McGinnis. Today with us, Terkel Strada. We're talking about a rescue operation. Montaigne said, and this came from another research book regarding the rescue operation, that the way people behave, he believed, was a matter of custom more than a matter of conscience. That is to say, not so much our nature as human beings, but how we have learned to behave towards each other. Can you look to the Danish sensibility in that light for a moment? Why do you think the Danes behaved as they did towards the Jews when the rest of the world was not behaving in this way at all?
Well, I think the Israeli historian Lini Yahil, who was actually doing the first scholarly work on the rescue operation, was close to the point when she summed her research up in the thesis that the rescue operation in Denmark was actually a society with a very strong democratic structure in civil society, not only in the state, but in civil society, which at that point showed that people did not wait for authorities to tell them what to do in this situation. They were sort of, they had the moral impetus to act on their own. And I feel that there's a strong tradition in Denmark that civil society is rather a very important part of the Danish population, of the living situation of the Danes, whereas the state is reacted to some more distance. In Danish civil societies, at this time when you could say an agricultural society was changing into an industrial society, there were basically two milieus of life in Denmark. The one was the agricultural one. And this, the agricultural milieu, countryside, was woven through by networks of cooperative structures where peasants would come together and manage a dairy farm, a dairy factory together, a slaughterhouse. They would buy their grain for sowing together in cooperatives. And every farmer actually, I mean, Denmark is basically family farming. Every farmer would be used from all these different cooperatives and organizations and unions in which he was a member. He would be used to making decisions as for his own good, and also decisions which would also be crucial to his fellow farmers. In the industrial milieu, the labor movement played a similar role. That should not be forgotten. There was a very high degree of industrial consensus in Denmark, which also meant that there was a tradition stemming back from the beginning of the century that employers and employees would work together in a, to preserve industrial peace and also to make the workers participate in what was at that time the highest living standard of the world. I think thus that, that these concrete experience of having power in your daily life and also having to make decisions sort of gave the people a basis for reacting quickly, and in this case also reacting the right way to a situation which was a terrible threat.
There is also the aspect of once again civil society, but how it integrated its members. The Germans said about other, this is a, I think an historian speaking, about other countries in Europe, that when they looked at those countries, they were pretty sure that citizens in those countries would turn away from the Jews, because the Jews lived separately in those countries, were not considered Poles. In Denmark, since the 1600s, when Jewish people first came to Denmark, they became part of that society. Is that right?
Yes. There were the Jewish community, the Jewish population of Denmark was always rather small. And it was very well and very quickly integrated into society. Denmark was one of the first European countries to grant full civil rights to Jews in 1814. The Jews of Denmark responded to the liberal surroundings, the liberal political and cultural conditions, by assimilating most of them to the Danish culture. There was a constant immigration to Denmark from the middle of the 17th century, that is after the 30 Years' War, which Denmark lost and lost its status as one of the great powers of Northern Europe, due to the lack of modernization of the society. And the Jews were called in to help modernize the society. That is, that the Danish elite, but also the people profiting from this modernization, would basically see the Jews as somebody who brought something good into the country. They had something to bring, just like Dutch farmers, which were also brought in at that time to teach the Danish how to grow garden produce. And these different immigrations, I could mention others from Poland, from Germany and so on, and from Sweden, these immigrations were rapidly integrated into Danish society. Only a minority of the Jews choose to stay true for the generations and generations to the Jewish faith. Some of the old traditional families, which originated in Portugal and Spain, and some of the and mostly those who stayed true to the Mosaic belief, were the immigrants coming into the country. And in the course of some generation, due to mixed marriage, and also very much due to the chances which were open to them if they would assimilate. I mean, for instance, the possibilities of going into the into public service, of getting a full and education, and so on and so forth. Well, they will turn more Danish than Jewish, actually, and Jewishness would become less a question of religion, or not at all a question of religion in the case of those who were baptized and became Christians, and more a question of a specific cultural background, a background which with a very heavy stress on intellectuality and innovative ability. Mm-hmm. And there were anti-Semitism in Denmark in the 19th century. There were also outbursts at a certain point after the granting of civil rights to the Jews. There were protests in Copenhagen. There were assaults against Jews in a couple of days, riots going on, which were much like the riots wave of riots going over Germany at that time, but to a lesser extent in Denmark. But basically, I think the Jews were accepted in a society, and they also did much to be accepted in the core, in the sense that they adjusted their way of life much to Danish society. Denmark did not, although it is situated on the edge between Western and Eastern Europe, in a sense, mm-hmm. at the port of the Baltic Sea, that means also the port to Russia, to the Baltic countries, to Poland, which were the places where the vast majority of Jews in Europe lived. Denmark did not get a separate community of, Eastern Jews, speaking another language, and having different habits and different way of dressing and what do I know. Since the Eastern Jews coming to Denmark, especially after the pogroms of 1905, 6 and 7 and so on in Russia, also assimilated rather quickly. And those who didn't want to assimilate wandered on to America.
Mm-hmm. Did the racism of the National Socialist Party seem very strange to Denmark, given the backdrop of the Danish sensibility, or was this, were the 1930s witnessed from Denmark in Germany seen as just another wave of anti-Semitism across the continent?
Frankly, I think that anti-Semitism was not a topic in Denmark, neither as, in the majority of the population. Neither anti-Semitism on behalf of Danes nor abroad. It was simply not perceived as a topic. So the ideology of Nazi Germany, this was the neighboring country, mm-hmm. and the big one. The ideology was, Danish Nazis tried to import that, but it was sensed as something strange and un-Danish. And especially the racist part was rejected by the Danes. There was some, people would say it's a good thing that Adolf Hitler creates the highways and that unemployment is not any longer in Germany to see, but the racial part was rejected by the Danes, and we must understand that the racial part of Nazi ideology, it's the very core of National Socialism, to my opinion, that this racial part on behalf of the Danes could have had actually some attractivity, since they were considered to be part of the German race, of the Aryan race, and that is, they were to become part of the master people of Europe if the German plans were actually put into practice. Mm. So there was an appeal in Norway. We could see that, at least a considerable minority of the Norwegian people actually found this kind of racism a good thing. But in Denmark, it was rejected. And I must say, it was not even in the very much in the way that there was much discussion about it. One laughed about it. One found, well, the Germans always have an inferiority complex and they are trying to take it out this way. Mm-hmm. We Danes don't have to do that. We are not so insecure about our identity as Nordic people. And part of being Nordic is also, one important part is to be tolerant. Tolerant to the people who are different than ourselves, to open our homes for them, to take guests. And I think this was the approach, actually, of the Danes, the vast majority of the Danish people in the 30s. And this is, of course, also one precondition why the Jews were treated as fellow Danish citizens. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it the way that actually many of the Danes participating in the rescue action did not rescue Jews, but Danes, yes, in their own opinion.
Dirk Ostrada is with us today on Conversations. I mentioned earlier that he had been a research fellow in a study of Nazism that was led by Professor Hans Mommsen between 1988 and 1992. Terkel's participation was an investigation of the Volkswagen Corporation during Nazism. His special research area, VW's exploitation of foreign labor, especially Jewish slave labor during the time. This is Conversations on KUAC. I would like you to look for us at the development of the final solution. On October 1st, 1943, what the Nazis demanded of Denmark had been in operation since 1941 and 42 throughout Germany and in the rest of occupied Europe. But it seems to me, in listening to you talk in other venues, that the final solution was an evolving force, was kind of developed decision by decision by decision until the Nazis said, we will exterminate all the Jews. Am I right in that summation, and can you look at that thought for us for a moment?
Yes. Basically, I think it is true that, we must know that anti-Semitism was the very core of Hitler's ideology. That he already, during his prison stay in 1923 to 25, when he wrote the book Mein Kampf, the only book he wrote, which became kind of the Bible of National Socialism, that already here it was clear to everyone that the main enemy of National Socialism was the Jew, as it was called, the stereotypization of a whole people. And that he had fantasies of annihilating the Jews, drive them out of Europe, drive them out of the German sphere of influence. But the Nazi Party did not have, and also did Hitler not have, concrete ideas about how this should happen, actually, until the summer 1941, the German policy was to force the Jews to emigrate from the German-controlled areas of Europe. This idea functioned, one could say, on behalf of the Germans, rather successful, since two-thirds of the German Jewish population was actually forced to emigrate during the period from 1933 to 1939, leaving only 150,000 in that country. But of course, after the war broke out, after the German attack on Poland, this immigration policy was not possible any longer, since there were no boundaries anymore, but only fronts surrounding Germany. And at the same time, Germany in Poland, and after that also in the Soviet Union, caught hold of the vast majority of the Jewish population of Europe. Those were numbers which could not be forced to immigrate the same way this had been done by the German and also by the Austrian Jews. So they were taken into ghettos, sort of in the beginning only to wait there for the ending of the war so that it would be possible again to drive them out as it was planned. Only then, in the course of 1941, the whole situation was radicalized very much. in connection with the German war against the Soviet Union, which was conceived of not as a normal war, but as a war to annihilate the Soviet Union, the communism, and Jewry. There was, in the Nazi fantasies, a identity between communism and Jewry, and Jewry and capitalism too. That didn't bother them. That this was a contradictory. Until the spring and summer of 41, I think we must look at this whole process of escalating persecution against the Jews as sort of a step-by-step escalation, radicalization, which was not planned. There was no master plan for the final solution, neither with Hitler nor with Heinrich Himmler and the SS, who were actually the agents of what happened in these years. But in the course of the planning of the attack on the Soviet Union were also involved fantasies that now is the final solution to Germany's problems, being a small country with not enough land and not enough raw materials and not enough energy sources, would now to be solved. And this created also the, the mood or in the German political elite, that the Jewish question, which it was called, was also now to reach its final solution, and this was done by massacres in the Soviet Union, and this process then very quickly ended up in building special camps, in extermination camps. Where the Jews were annihilated on, an industrial basis. From that point on, there's no doubt that intention was the driving force. But the genocide was not planned beforehand. It emerged out of this combination of different factors.
I have a question not for the historian, but for the man, if you can. If such an abomination as the final solution was evolutionary, decision by decision by decision, was what we think now of as the evil of Nazism also something that happened, if you characterize it as evil, decision by decision by decision, behavior by behavior? I can kill this person and nothing happens to me. I can kill these 50 people and nothing happens to the state. We can kill these 100,000 people and there's no consequence to us.
Yes and no, I would say. The fundamental evil of National Socialism was already found in the National Socialist ideology, which emerged already in the early 1920s
when
the
party racism, was
in this hatred against different races that was also directed towards the Russians and the Poles, but basically and had a special quality against the Jews. So I would say the ideology. That means also the mental readiness to treat the people considered of bad race ruthlessly was there long before the Nazis got into power and got into a position where they were able to do so. Only there was a great discrepancy between the ideology and, you could say, tactics. It was not like a Marxist party, which has an ideology, then it has a strategy, and it has developed tactics to be put into praxis. The Nazis had their ideology and praxis, and these two levels were interrelated and also interacting in the course of the process. So when the Nazis came into power, and this happened also a little bit as a shock for themselves, that everything went that fast and that they suddenly were able to catch grasp of a whole state apparatus, they were quite unprepared for that. And that means that they measures they took were a little bit at random, but always aiming at the most radical solution, which realistically was in sight at the specific time. So the evil, you could say, the evil as a thought, the evil on the mental level, on the ideological level, was there all the time, quite unchanged during the times. But the praxis, killing people, persecution, discriminating, the whole rollback of the assimilation process, which had been an important part of the history of the Jews in Central Europe, was only developed like in the course of time. Very often, very short-range decisions were taken, which at the end, in the effect, ended up by realizing, by putting into practice the National Socialist overall idea of a final solution in the sense of annihilating the Jews.
I should say, so people know, that Terkelstreda is in the United States as we are recording this, with an exhibit of photographs and information developed for the Museum of Danish Resistance in Copenhagen. The exhibit is called Denmark in October 1943, The Danish Jews Rescue from Annihilation. It's also a subject of a book written not in English but in Danish, published in Copenhagen in 1993, written by Terkelstreda, called A Living Wall, about the history of the Danish Jews and that rescue operation. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. There are around the world today behaviors by groups of people against other groups of people that are clearly inhumane, whether it's occurring in Bosnia or whether in Iraq against the Kurds or whether in Africa by one population against the other. Two questions in one. Is there anything going on that you feel approaches what happened in the 30s and 40s in Germany? And clearly this is not just a German problem. What do you think the capability of humankind is to do this to ourselves again?
Well, it's two very large questions.
Yeah, it's too big, so pick the part you'd like.
The first one is something going on for the time being which could be comparable. I would say definitely no.
Yeah.
One very important difference between the Holocaust, the attempt to annihilate all Jews on the side of the Germans, and what we are seeing, for instance, in Bosnia, is the fact that in Germany a state apparatus tried to attempt a genocide. Whereas what we are seeing in Bosnia and Herzegovina is atrocities which originate on a local level, you could say, as a radicalization and also a dehumanization of warfare in a civil war. So these are atrocities which have their explanation on a local level, not on the level of a state apparatus applying these atrocities towards a whole people. And this is the second important difference, that we haven't seen since 1945 the attempt to murder a people, old and young, babies and the elderly, as everyone. So this is one of the things which make the attempt to annihilate the Jews a unique experience in the history of mankind. And this, of course, then brings us to the other question you posed. Yeah. I hope it will stay that way, that this would be the first and the last attempt to annihilate a whole people. But we must say, especially as a historian, one has to say, when it happened once, this means that these things can happen again. Because the fact that it happened must convince us that these abilities are in men. There is a whole discussion about the Holocaust, about the National Socialism, as to if the Holocaust was actually an act of modernity, an act of the modern world, the bureaucratic dehumanization of society, the social creation, one could say, of a moral indifference towards the other, and whether this should be a special part of the modern world. There's another discussion going on which relates the Holocaust especially to the reactionary parts of National Socialist ideology. And if that discussion is right, then we can feel secure, since modern society has proceeded and progressed since these days. I would prefer not to take a stand in this discussion, since I feel that the Holocaust has very modern elements in it, and also elements which one can say stand in the tradition of persecution and anti-Semitism since the Jews were driven out of Palestine, of Israel, shortly after the start of our already in the first century. And this would be a continuity, which, the way I see it, which actually ended with the emergence of a full developed modern society, which is now almost encompasses all of the world. So atrocities will happen again and again, I'm afraid, and I'm very much concerned about the system and developing in the former Soviet Union. But I do not think that an attempt to annihilate a whole people in the way this was done against the Jews can happen again. Mm-hmm. We must hope that humanity is able also to learn from its mistakes. But, I mean, in the last end, this is a question of hope, and there, historical science is not of very much use.
What do you make of the people who say the Holocaust didn't exist?
Well,
it seems like it's nothing I ever heard until the last 4 or 5 years or something. Where is that coming from?
In Germany, in Europe, people have been saying these things all the time. The Nazis didn't disappear in 1945. They continued having their networks. They continued to be there. They having their veterans unions and reunions and what do I know. And they have been claiming these things all the time. The new thing about it is that for specific reasons, especially in the so-called New World, that is United States and Canada, Australia, Latin America, this discourse has emerged and obviously is also supported by greater financial, supported financially from sources I do not know. But this discourse has emerged, claiming that the Holocaust did not take place. I mean, this is a point where a historian is practically helpless. You cannot convince these people if they do not want to see reality. If they go to Auschwitz, there is one example in Denmark, an Auschwitz guard who is claiming the Holocaust did not take place. He was a guard in Auschwitz. The man is lying. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. He knows that himself, but he has a reason, political reason, for lying. So he went there. Everybody who goes to Auschwitz can see the installations. The historians can tell them how the installations were preserved since the time when the camp was liberated by the Russians. And there's no doubt about what happened. Only I think there will always be a minority. I hope it will stay a minority of, what do you call it? In German, you have the word unbelehrbaren, people you cannot teach. You have also another German word, ewig gestrigen. That means the people who are forever living in the past. Mm. And you will have this milieu. I was hoping that it will die out with the old Nazis. But obviously, for specific reasons, the present crisis in modern society, which has very much to do with the specific unemployment of the young, has given it another round. And of course, there are people who are willing to exploit this for personal reasons or because they believe in this. But the only thing you can put up against it is enlightenment. We can tell, the historians can tell what happened, documentation of the facts. We now know how many Jews perished in the Holocaust, country for country for country. This has been sorted out not only by statistics from the camps and so on and so forth, but also by cross-checking with the demographical data of every country involved, every county involved, and so on and so forth. Tremendous work has been done on that topic in Israel, Germany, and the United States. So we must just hope that people will listen to the sensible voices, those who have a solid historical background for what they're saying. That's all there is to say to that.
Dirkel Strader, thank you very much for joining us on Conversations.
Thank you.
Dirkel Strader has been a guest of the Danish Language Department at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, and by Dirkel, you tell me.
Yeah, by the Danish State Research Council for the Humanities.
Thank you very much, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you join me again next week.